Hi folks, this podcast is a conversation from late the other evening. Myself and Konstantin Gordiev, economist, sat down to discuss events in Ukraine. Konstantin has a unique view on it, being raised in the Soviet Union, working in Ireland and becoming an Irish citizen, and now lecturing in the US. So I think it's really, really good. We go very broad on this. We talk about the conflict, the geopolitics, the economics, and I even narrowed out a little bit of economic global financial crisis nostalgia. If you're listening to this now and it's still Sunday, we're live Sunday evening in the Sugar Club for a Tortoise Shack show. That's going to be excellent. There are literally a handful of tickets left. They may be gone by the time you listen to this, but if you are interested in coming, it's eventbrite.ie, so just go to eventbrite.ie, throw in Tortoise Shack, you'll find us there. If you're listening to this and you think that, you know, you like what we do, we've no ads, we've no sponsors, we rely on you. If you think that you would buy us a cup of coffee if you met us in the street or something like that, maybe do it that way. Do it virtually. Buy us that virtual cup of coffee. It's patreon.com/tortoiseshack. And apologies because Ben, my dog, is barking in the background. I'll let you enjoy the podcast now. Talk to you soon. Take care. Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber podcast. My name is Tony Groves and I'm still going solo, folks. He's still pretending that he's milking it for all. It's nearly a month now and he hasn't done a tap. Bit of housekeeping. We are live on Sunday in the Sugar Club on Leeson Street for a live podcast, which will feature a brilliant panel of, including two family members who lost their siblings in the Stardust tragedy. And I know that sounds a bit grim, but I promise you it's going to be a fantastic night that you don't want to miss. Tickets are available now on eventbrite.ie, so you'll find them there. Look forward to seeing lots of you there. Anyway, that's the plugging out of the way. I am delighted to be rejoined on the podcast by the last time we spoke to the guest, we'd gone 700 episodes in between appearances. So I think we're down to 70 now. I'm joined by Professor of Economics in Denver, Colorado, is where he lays his hat these days, folks. Konstantin Gordiev. Konstantin, thank you for coming back on and chatting to me.
Thanks, Tony. And listen, my best wishes to Martin for his recovery, the speediest recovery possible.
Thank you. Thank you, friend. He'll appreciate that. We're obviously going to talk about what's happened in the world, how it's, I'm going to use the phrase, it's all a bit fucked at the moment, Konstantin, but it's you have a unique perspective, because I described you before we came on air as an Irish Armenian Russian you have a foot in so many camps there that you can actually touch on this. But we've had really interesting conversations. I remember we shared a car journey and we talked about, you know, the history of Europe, the history of the Soviet Union, the history of Armenia, and some of the things that I learned just in those few hours. What do you make of this mess of the last few weeks? It's only, I know the conflict is only 8-9 days old now, but it's just an absolute humanitarian disaster. But worse than that, it's dragging everybody else into there's men sitting behind keyboards now saying, yes, we need to buy more weapons. We need guns. We need fighter jets in the skies over Cork.
Oh, yes. No, absolutely. And there are people out there who are voting in different polls, you know, saying that we need to have NATO directly confronting the Russian troops and so forth. It is probably, you know, none of us, I certainly did not anticipate that this turn of the events happening before it happened. Most of the analysts that I know of that I would have respect for as being independent analysts in terms of their thinking did not anticipate that it would go so far. It is an absolutely, you use the F word, it's a clusterfuck, okay? And it's not just such on a level of geopolitics and grand strategies of the states and the juxtaposition between Russia, whether it's historical juxtaposition or the present time juxtaposition, and the West. It's certainly not just about Ukraine alone. It is at every level of your existence touching you. It touches you in terms of your European background, European culture, European history. It touches us on a human level because here we are at the in the 21st century, and we are witnessing a major power trying to resolve geopolitical grievances and historical grievances. It is immaterial whether they're relevant or not, or whether they are true or not, but trying to resolve it through the use of force that is engaging directly civilian population in a neighboring state, which did not carry out any physical aggression against that state. It's just something that we thought that we have set back, you know, years ago into the history to be remembered and never to be repeated. And yet we are here again. For me, as you mentioned, yes, I mean, like I'm a total mutt culturally, historically, and, you know, citizenship-wise as well, and nationality-wise. For me, this is unimaginable, you know, if you want, internal conflict situation. You know, obviously, as you mentioned, I'm half Russian. I'm a Russian national, dual with the Irish national being as well. And I'm half Armenian, half Russian. But I am product of Soviet Union. I grew up in the environment where I had all the friends of different nationalities around me. I grew up with a family which was living, including my uncle living in Ukraine at the time. I genuinely think of Ukraine and I think of the other republics of the former Soviet Union as being brothers and sisters to us, historically, culturally. And when those republics gained independence from the Soviet Union, and to me, Soviet Union has always been an evil empire. Yes, there were some good things about it, of course. And yes, we were happy in a way living in there. But nonetheless, it is ethically a bankrupt system, you know, of management, of rule, of politics, and so forth. So when those countries gained their independence, there was not a shadow of question about the legitimacy of that independence. So, of course, there are issues that have been inherited as a result of that. You look at, for example, confrontational ongoing conflict between Armenia and Azerbaijan. You have other points of contact in terms of the frictions and disagreements between the members, between the former parts of the Soviet Union. But the idea that Russian troops will be invading Ukraine and waging an aggression war in Ukraine is an anathema to me on a personal level. I have so many friends who are either Ukrainian ethnically or live in Ukraine still. Some of them live in Russia and they are Ukrainian ethnically and so forth. There are so many points where you feel it as if it's two brothers who are going at each other with deadly weapons, let's put it this way, okay? There is no way of justifying it, geopolitically or historically, honestly.
But not only is there no way of justifying that, like when people keep reaching for a clumsy, you know, oh, it reminds me of the North, it reminds me of this, it reminds me of that. And you can't, you know, copy and paste things onto one another. But one thing that does stand out to me is people saying things like, well, you know, there's a million people, passport holders there, Russian passports. And I spoke to people, absolutely there are. And I spoke to people in Moscow who said, yes, absolutely. I hold a Ukrainian passport and a Russian, because it helps me able to move within the EU and within Russia. And it also helps me, it also shares some of my values. So there's, I don't see why that has to be a conflict.
There is absolutely no need for that conflict. In fact, the relations have been developing, with bumps, ups and downs, and with issues over a period of time during the independence of both states. Russia has not played a constructive role over decades in terms of engaging with Ukraine as the fully equivalent partner in terms of trade and investment, beyond any doubts. In Ukraine, there are its own issues and the problems, and there are, of course, difficulties of growing the democracy. In many ways, Ukraine is ahead of Russia in many democratic developments. In some ways, especially economic developments, it is behind Russia. None of that is material, as I say, to the whole point of what we're witnessing today. None of that in any way justifies, nor even explains what is happening today on the ground in Ukraine. This is why, and of course, what is happening on the ground in Ukraine today, that aggression by Russia against Ukraine, can never be seen as the even an attempt to resolve any of those issues. So we're in the worst case scenario possible right now, both as Russians, we are also, or as Russia goes, we're also in the worst case scenario as Ukraine goes, and where the worst case scenario as Europe goes. Perhaps the United States is in a slightly better kind of set of circumstances, primarily because it doesn't carry the cost of what is happening in Ukraine and in Russia today.
This is where we're going with this conversation, and I will get to it. I will get to the cost and the economic cost and the personal cost. But I want to ask one other thing when we talk about those. I've spoken at length with Ukrainian parliamentarians, and they've talked about some of the things that you've hinted at there, where when independence came, it wasn't without problems. It wasn't done. They've made mistakes. They did treat people poorly. They didn't, recognize different cultural entities in certain ways. They've tried to revert course, and there's no hiding that in the people I speak to. But they do talk about, the development of a rights-based society. They also talk about, things like the Green New Deal. They talk about things like trying to, but ultimately, we see Putin's bloody speech where he talks about, it's still part of us. It's one of ours. It's ahistorically, some of it's very ahistorically just bullshit.
Bizarre. And even if you are to for a nanosecond step into his boots and you say to yourself, okay, you purport to treat Ukrainian people as being equivalent to Russian people and being, brothers and sisters to Russian people, something that I would agree with completely, but hey, I would agree with that on the level of anybody in humanity. We all are human beings, but if you are to take Putin's positions there, how can you then justify bombing them? How can you justify then rolling the tanks into their country? How can you justify bullying them in economic sphere, okay? You mentioned something in terms of, of course, these are, remember the period of the 1990s when Ukraine gained its independence and Russia gained its independence and the Soviet Union collapsed, and then the period of privatization and all, everybody made mistakes. Some of those mistakes were, if you want, transmitted or imposed onto those countries from abroad, not always by ill will, but just by lack of experience from, say, for example, U.S. advisors and European advisors as well. But setting all of that aside, everybody made mistakes. But when you go back and you look at the history of Ukrainian state evolution, even weighing all of these mistakes in, Ukraine had a very benign attitude towards the Russian-speaking minorities. It had for a long period of time, full recognition of Russian language. It had for a very long period of time, effectively no nationalistic tendencies in terms of education in the high school or in the elementary school or middle school. Ukraine has been throughout that period of transition from the Soviet kind of empire to the to its own independent state was much more benign, much less, if you want, made much fewer mistakes in this space of developing the civil society than other former republics, such as, for example, the Central Asian republics, where you had, and here's an Armenian, I don't know if the listeners would remember that, but back in the early 1990s, there was the whole effectively anti-Armenian pogroms happening in Tajikistan, in other parts of Central Asia, but primarily in Tajikistan. Nothing like that ever happened in Ukraine. So to say that Ukraine is somehow oppressed ethnic minorities on a systemic basis is historically wrong. It's just simply not there. Yes, there are grievances. Yes, there are issues and frictions, of course. And it's only natural that you would have them when the society, the size of Ukrainian society and complexity of Ukrainian society evolves into the new democratic systems, into the new institutions, into the entirely new institution of sovereignty. So the way to deal with that is for Russia and other states to engage constructively with the Ukrainian society, to share with them resources, to share with them goodwill, open up both economic and cultural spheres to more direct exchanges, to more direct educational flows and so forth. And Russia early on tried to do that, in fairness, okay? But I think since roughly speaking, mid-noughties, that process stalled. And the outcome of that stalling of that process is where we are today. I mean, and, you know, again, historically, it's unjustifiable. You mentioned President Putin's speech. I've seen excerpts from it. We don't know, of course, what was said at that meeting beyond what was broadcast to us. But it's almost inconceivable to me to think of President Putin, who used to be a rational, long-term strategic player in geopolitical sphere, and we as analysts could discern rationality in his decision-making. Whether we agreed with it or not, that's a different issue, but at least we could see that. That speech, that mumbo-jumbo of historical cliches and, you know, manipulated facts taken from history, was really scary to watch, because this is a nuclear power where the leader is, you know, engaging in justifying that which cannot be justified.
I agree with you to a large degree on that. I do think, obviously, in the birthing pangs of the democratic Ukraine, there are people who will say that you said mistakes were made. Absolutely they were, but fighting, I've spoken to other people who say, we say that, well, the war started, they'll tell you, well, the war started in 2014 in many ways, in many areas, in many regions. And, you know, there's been a lot of bad has happened, but nonetheless, nothing that accounts for this. I want to change direction for a moment, because, and it's a strange one, because we're all learning all as we go. You things that you probably knew growing up, but there's precedent when it comes to, say, Ukraine. It was referred to as the breadbasket. You know, the third biggest grower of wheat, the fifth biggest of corn. You know, these sort of things. They were also subjected to what I would call a forced famine, whereby these things have happened historically. Of course, they didn't feature in President Putin's in his speech either. No. Funny enough, he didn't mention those things. But as an economic situation, Constantine, the world before this was happening, we're in a cycle of inflation. Every central banker in the world, including your own, was saying, oh, maybe it's transitory. Let's come up with this new word and call it transitory. Do you remember every time Trichet, he'd say, you'll remember this. If Trichet says the word vigilant, your interest rate is going up by 0.5%. Do you remember this?
Yeah.
And nerds like me and you were going, watching the speech, going, he said, vigilant, everybody run and fix your interest rate.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. So the new buzzword has become transitory, but we're trapped in this cycle now. Now, I put it to you that this has been happening before, that the access of Russia, China has been already making the post-pandemic recovery more difficult. They haven't decided. They've left sort of things whereby we're going to trade to the east now. We're going to trade in this way. We're going to remove some of the. We're going to trade in gold. In fact, we're going to stockpile some gold, and we're going to ignore some of the markets that the US are. And a lot of this was. I mean, this suits China in a way as an economic tool to weaken the American economy, and that economically speaking, you're saying America is not as impacted directly by this war. It is very impacted by what is effectively a bigger game going on. And I know I hate to say it in those terms, people are dying, it sounds cruel, but I have to talk about it in the fact of there's a reason Xi Jinping walked along in the Winter Olympics with President Putin. It was the first time he stepped out with a world leader in a number of years. He sent a clear message. The axis has been there. And now we look at, you know, that a weakening of an already strained U.S. economy that people are saying Biden's approval ratings are through the floor because people are saying the cost of living crisis is too high. All of this is going to start biting. It's biting the economy, then it bites politics. And that is part of this game, I put it to you.
Oh, no, you are correct. And when it comes to economics biting the politics, we are here in the United States in the midterm election cycle. And there is, you know, not a snowball's chance in hell, unless something major happens, that the Democrats are going to retain their control of the Congress. And that's also relates to the subsequent, of course, presidential elections coming up. You mentioned President Biden's approval ratings. I mean, I personally think that it's really tragic because it is behavioral, really knee-jerk in reaction from the population by and large. But it doesn't matter how you spin it. The latest YouGov poll shows, you know, 53% approval ratings for President Biden. Donald Trump at that time in his presidency had 56% approval rating. It's a very tough environment. You mentioned the China-US economic competition. Very interesting thing that we observe currently. Yes, the latest sanctions imposed against Russia involve sanctions against the Central Bank of Russia, and in particular targeting the sovereign wealth reserves that are held offshore by the central bank. Of course, central banks from all over around the world hold different assets offshore. Sometimes we think, for example, when the Bank of Japan buys U.S. treasuries, that those treasuries are domiciled somehow physically as certificates in the Bank of Japan. No, they are not. They're actually in the Fed, yes? And they are on the electronic system of the Fed. So as a result of that, they are very easy to seize. You mentioned gold. Yes, China started buying gold. Russia has been accumulating gold since, roughly speaking, at pretty aggressive clips since about 20. Russia has not sold out of its treasuries. So Chinese government currently holds vast amounts of U.S. government debt. And big concern right now, and that's something that hasn't been really percolating too much through the likes of the mainstream media yet, but I already see some analysts currently starting to talk about this. China is watching the sanctions against Russia pretty closely. And, you know, Chinese government will have to start disposing of those government bonds, U.S. government bonds, because they're easy to seize, they're easy to freeze, and effectively they are, you know, useless from the point of view of serving as a hedge against future potential sanctions. When that happens, do remember that when you take out of the U.S. Issuance of bonds and holdings of government bonds, international holdings of government bonds, when you take out the U.S. Fed, most of the rest is owned by central banks, and most of the rest is of those central banks, the biggest one is People's Bank of China, then you're looking at the significant potential impact on government bond yields, cost of borrowing for the U.S. government. In fact, some people are saying that, hey, we're about to test the modern monetary theory, ideas with China selling the treasuries. It's an open question whether China will do or not. It's very difficult to understand what Chinese position is exactly. They're in the sweet spot right now. They just gained access to all of the resources of Russia at a huge discount.
Yeah, I kind of point out the listeners. China aren't sitting back going, Asher, we'll give you a hand out there. They're making it like bandits here. You know, someone was saying that we're paying $1 billion in the EU for gas and oil from Russia currently, $1 billion a day. I can guarantee you China are getting a nice discount on the stockpile that has no longer been exported.
China is in fascinatingly strong position here. I mean, China, even before this conflict, exercised what we call monopsony power or monopoly buyer power in the markets for Russian natural gas. And that was because Russian gas fields are aging. The main producing gas fields are aging. And the production and exploration shifted farther east, away from the existent Western-oriented pipeline networks. So the Power of Siberia pipeline is designed to supply natural gas directly to China. China actually originally promised to contribute money to build that, to invest in it, okay, be an investor and shareholder in it. And then it actually discovered that, hey, since the pipe terminates at our border, why the hell would we give any money to the Russians, you know, for any investment? They will have no choice but ship gas through it to us. So they exercised monopoly power on that. And then last year, they managed to actually squeeze Russians down in terms of the price on the gas supplies through that pipeline, precisely by pointing and saying that, whom else are you going to sell it to? The pipe ends here, yes? So, you know, Russians learned from that in their LNG, for example, plant on the Far East, on the Pacific coast. They actually targeted more supply to the likes of Korea and to Japan. So as a result of that, Chinese had to go in as the investors in that LNG plant. And it's a bit different dynamic. But now with sanctions, once again, China is the only buyer, not even the preferred buyer, the only buyer, and it can call effectively the price. So in a way, when I say that, you know, United States is not impacted directly, it's because United States is not paying the price tag of direct sanctions. It's not the U.S. banks who are going to be short of capital because their loans to the Russian corporates have been, you know, effectively null and void. Yes. Or, you know, there's a default, you know, ongoing, potential default ongoing in terms of the corporate debt. And that's not going to impact directly American economy. But in the geopolitical competition space, as you mentioned, strengthening of China is, of course, going to have a direct impact on the U.S. economy. What's interesting is also when you look geopolitically, and we don't know yet where that game is heading. If you look at the General Assembly vote yesterday and the countries that abstained, everyone talks about Belarus, you know, voting, you know, in favor of Russia and all that. Who cares? That's a different story. Yes. What really is interesting is that India has been effectively lining up with China and with Pakistan. It's not lining up with the United States. It's not lining up with the West.
When Russia vetoed a UN Security Council vote to condemn itself a few days ago, India abstained.
Correct. And you abstained again in the General Assembly vote.
So when you see that, that's a pretty clear message. It shows, like, when we talk about these are huge economies. These are huge growing economies. I mean, like,
South Africa is another. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you look at what's happening in terms of we live in especially in Europe and in the United States. And like, say, for example, in Japan, we live in the bubble world. We live in the world of Western advanced economies. We are forgetting that most of the population of this world doesn't live where we live. We are forgetting that most of the growth in the global economy is not happening where we live. And those regions, those countries are actually not as uniformly on one side of the conflict that is going on right now.
And nor are they happy to join the model that has seen what they would say has been extractivism for decades towards them. So, and that is fair. Like, I mean, the World Bank's report will show you, what is it, for every dollar put in, 24 was extracted. I mean, that is the balance of power there. And when you look at it from those point of view, and another thing that was interesting, actually, and again, I'm reminiscing with you now, because we're old school. Do you remember we used to refer to the BRIC countries?
Brazil,
India, and China, and they used to have these bonds, folks. And you go into a bank if you had $5,000, and you could invest in the BRIC countries, the emerging.
That's right.
Yeah, and like these countries are now looking back at everybody else, going, yeah, we're no longer a plaything of some of this. Whether you agree with their governance, how they do things, whether the corruption levels are, or whatever their democracy is like. You don't get to say anymore, and that's when you see India playing like with abstaining in those votes. Yes, it's very definitely a message. I can we then flip the thing and look at Europe for a moment. We're looking at like €2 for a liter of petrol shortly, if not already in some places. I've seen it for €1.90. You know, I've seen it around in those. We're looking at we had inflation pre this. We had cost of living crisis. We saw, and you'd probably be aware of this, Blackstone reporting its greatest ever profits in terms of trading. And folks, if you're not aware, Blackstone effectively made most of its money in the last 24 months from owning residential properties and commercial units and hiking up rents. And, you know, Ireland is particularly exposed to that market because we said that's what builds all our houses at the moment, this built-to-rent model.
Really?
Yeah, I know. Oh man,
I know. I mean, you and I were engaging about that. You know, that you were joking about the vulture funds. You know, and the only government I know in the world that actually has an objection to the term vulture fund, which is actually in Investopedia.
You can
go into Investopedia, and it's a valid term in finance. You know, been for ages. The only government that has an issue with it is the Irish government.
Yeah.
I mean, to what extent they love those funds and for what, I have no idea.
Well, more importantly, we've heard them go on national media and say it might put them off. It won't put them off. What would put them off is if you tax them. What would put them off is
if you have a functional market for property in a country, that would put them off. Because the vulture funds don't go into functional markets. They go, by definition, into the markets that are utterly, the more dysfunctional they are, the more eagerly they go into them. So if you have vulture funds in your economy, you know something is terribly wrong. Yeah. Let's put it this way, okay? Yeah. And it's not their fault. It's what they do, you know? But the idea that we have the government which is saying that they are the only suppliers of housing is really probably should be a kind of a sign that you got to do something different in order to change the supply of housing, if the only suppliers of housing are, you know, rental property provider vulture funds.
And that is a huge, huge issue. And I don't know if we can address, without a huge change in the state's idea, because unfortunately, the state then are effectively subsidizing those same vulture funds, whether it's through tax incentives, guaranteed yield returns, and, you know, all sorts of
no, absolutely deals. And but, you know, when you think about the rent supplements and things like that as well, you know, of course, yeah, no, look, I mean, you know, and I'm involved in that space, you know, on the charity side, you know, in Ireland still, and you know, I can tell you that, you know, vulture funds are competing not only, or you know, pricing out not only the state itself, they're pricing out the non-profits and charities.
Yeah,
you know? It's a zero-sum game, Tony. It's not a game, and you know that, you know, as well as I do, you know. And the problem is that the problem we have, all of us, is communicating that, you know, to the politicians and to the general public. Vulture funds are the zero-sum game. They do not add value. They do not create new property. They do not create new investment. They are supplanting the investment or displacing investment or replacing investment that should happen in a functional market.
Yeah.
That should happen naturally in a functional market.
And I genuinely would love to get you back on just to have a specific thing on this, because I think there's so much that we need to unpeel on this, because, you know, this there is a nonsense out there that, you know, all supply is good supply, but if it's only one supply, it's not working. But
I want
to broaden it for a moment. Some of the things that are happening now in the EU in terms of economic sanctions, like we've seen the Russian central bank having to double its interest rate from 10 to 20%. We've seen things like state TV, Russia Today, or RT as it's now called, taken down off many platforms. We've seen, you know, as a super yacht seized in Germany. There's talk of super yachts in Barcelona. Will they get out of the port in time before the sanctions bite? We've seen Roman Abramovich trying to sell Chelsea before, because he's been given a little bit of a window by the British government to say, listen, if you can do it in a few months, we're going to give you a kind of a cooling off period, I suppose.
Or get the hell out of here, period.
But constantly, is this all just going to end up in, like, it's going to cost, I know it's going to cost me at the dinner table, because that's the reality.
Course.
So the reality of this is, how do we make sure that those actual sanctions work on making Russia think, actually, we can't occupy Ukraine, which, by the way, they can't. It's 40 million people. It's too big. Even if they deploy 500,000 soldiers into the field, they can't do that. But if the economic cost, when does it become that, as at that point where they say, actually, we can't, this is a folly, and everybody's just losing out?
So the sanctions that have been announced so far are utterly, completely unprecedented. Nobody could have expected the scope and the depth of those sanctions, the range of them and the depth. They're traditional types of sanctions, but also what we call nuclear option, SWIFT sanctions, are what's known in finance, you know, kind of as nuclear option type of sanctions. And then, of course, the central bank sanctions are something that has never been deployed ever to any on that scale to, and to in relation to any sizable economy in the past. So as a result of that, those sanctions are already taken at all. If you look at, for example, yesterday's meeting of President Putin with his economy minister and with Elvira Nabiullina, who is the head of the Central Bank of Russia, the body language on that end of that proverbially long table was absolutely speaking volumes. It was screaming the state of disbelief, state of depression, and state of not knowing what to do and how to respond to this juxtaposition of, on one side, the president of the country who is charging ahead with the invasion, and on the other side, the people who are competent enough, like Elvira Nabiullina, who is one of the most, probably one of the best currently central bankers in the world, knowing exactly what these sanctions mean and not knowing how to address and how to deal with them. So that certainly is there. So the sanctions are already biting. The anticipation of the sanctions was also quite evidently posing problems for Kremlin before even the invasion began. Remember the infamous meeting on the 22nd, I think, of February with the oligarchs and with the Industrial Chamber of Commerce that Putin held. And the head of the Chamber of Commerce, who is a very powerful business lobbyist, went at Putin at that meeting, literally saying that we need not not a military action. We need instead the reinforcement of our trade commitments to our partners. We need to rebuild the economy. We need to focus on investment and things like that. So in other words, those sanctions are biting. These are different types of sanctions. They're distinct from what we had before, after the 2014 and onwards, kind of pro forma, individual targeting sanctions, targeting smaller companies and smaller banks. We are now seeing the sanctions directly hitting the likes of Sberbank, shares down, 99%? But even apart from shares, who cares about the equity holders, generally speaking, you look at the bank, which is the biggest bank in the country, biggest deposit collecting bank in the country, effectively not being able to transact with anyone outside of Russia. So those sanctions are biting. At what point do those sanctions tip the, if you want, the balance towards the Kremlin reversing its decision making is unfortunately not a part of the kind of rational equation that I think has been considered currently. I think what is at play there is traditional power brokers' plays in the Kremlin. And from that point of view, the power brokers are pretty, they're pretty free from the pressure from the economy for now. So if the, what we call in Russian kind of terms, siloviki or power brokers game in Kremlin continues, then the only hope for the rest of the, for the rest of us is that the combined burden of economic depression and economic isolation that these sanctions will bring over a period of time into the Russian economy will lead to a popular effectively revolt. Okay, so that's a very long-term game.
Yeah, but I mean, we've seen already protests in St. Petersburg. We've seen protests and we've seen 1,800 people arrested. We've seen we've also seen celebrities, Russian celebrities, sports stars, protesting.
Academics, Moscow State University Alumni Association has just published yesterday an open letter signed by thousands of people, as far as I know. Absolutely, you're right. And this is actually is very interesting because what we're seeing right now is the demographic of protest, which is not necessarily aligned fully with the traditional kind of liberal, if you want, opposition. This is more younger, more educated people who are protesting.
But here's the problem. I'm going to ask a question. If we start to see them being impacted, do they get pushed back by another generation who say, actually, Putin might be right about this because look at that.
That's where 10 years ago you would have been correct, because 10 years ago the dominant generation in Russia would have been the older generation. Now, today, the dominant, the most active, you know, socially and politically and economically generation is the younger generation. And that holds some hope. But let's not confuse it, because Russia is very heterogeneous. Its younger generation is also split between kind of educated urban and less educated, less professional, more rural type of population. In that segment of the younger population, you have nationalism, but you also have perhaps stronger support towards the Siloviki type of structure of governance in Moscow. But what's crucial, and this is very interesting, because as we see now, we're seeing the death toll coming out of the Ukraine for the Russian troops. And also, as you mentioned, this is a country of 40 plus million people. You're not going to get away with 150,000 troops in there or 200,000. So we're talking about, there's a noise now about conscription. And if there's a general conscription opened up, that brings into the protest, if you want, pool of protesters, all of the mothers, all of the grandmothers, in other words, by and large, women.
Every babushka is going to come out and say,
exactly,
no way.
And when they are the hard supporters of Putin so far. When he loses that base, then everything is open. The game is completely open, because Siloviki then no longer have a popular base support on the ground.
Yeah.
We're not there yet, but that threat is certainly, remember, even in 2014, this movement by mothers protesting against the covert Russian operations in Ukraine, by, you know, civil society, small civil society groups raising the specter of Russian kids dying there, started to kind of change the balance there. That's what led to the freezing up of that conflict, to Russian government starting to kind of engage with the Minsk process and so forth. So there is a hope there, but the problem with the timeline of that hope is that it's highly uncertain. We don't know how long it will take. And in the meantime, it's an absolute pain point right now in Russia. But that said, and I want to make it absolutely 100% clear, it doesn't matter how much pain the Russian society is enduring right now, the pain of Ukrainian people is so much greater right now, and it is inflicted by the Russians. Terrible.
I mean, it's funny. I speak regularly to a couple of Ukrainian MPs, and you know my politics. I wouldn't necessarily share the same. I wouldn't. Zelensky wouldn't be my kind of capitalist, shall we say? And that's the.
Sure.
But who gives a shit when it comes to something like
this?
I want to save lives. I want to see a start and end of missiles falling. Can I ask you for a closing on this for this evening? Do you think that ultimately the EU itself is going to? Actually, I'm probably going to answer my own question, because unfortunately it seems to be going that way. They're slipping through too many things, Constantine, that are going to cause a militarization of the EU now. It's a Lenin quote. We've heard it often. There are decades where nothing happens, and then there are weeks that everything happens. And right now,
that's right.
We saw a couple of Irish MEPs object to a condemnation, and you know, you can debate their reasons for doing that, and I can disagree with them on many points, and I do frequently. But I do know within some of the things that were slipped in, it was around LNG. It was around militarization. It was around spending and things like that. You know, from a selfish Irish perspective, the ESRI recommended the Irish government that it doubled its budget to spend building themselves, like a state building. How we talked about fixing the market. They talked about maybe the state actually building as opposed to paying vulture funds to build. And they said, no, we don't, we're not borrowing for that today. In the Dáil, Artánish just said, we need to have a real serious question about neutrality and what we start doing in terms of our own military. It kind of...
Tony, to me, all of that, what you are pointing out there, is the legacy of our failure to learn from the global financial crisis. You mentioned Ireland, for example, not borrowing money right now to build social housing and to solve other problems as well, okay? And yet we are still continuing, as far as I'm aware, to effectively extinguish hundreds of millions of dollars every year in order to convert the Anglo-Irish flipping bonds.
We're still carrying that. We're still carrying billions of debt there.
We have not learned the main lesson. And unfortunately, we are now starting to see the price tag for not learning it coming through. And that main lesson is you need to have a civil and political institutions, civil society and political institutions that are open to debate, discussion, dialogue, and actually experimentation with different policy solutions in order to be able to meet the challenges and risks that might be thrown to you from outside by Vladimir Putin or someone else, or by internal processes such as the legacy of the crisis or the legacy of the recession and so forth. We have not done it. And as you said, Europe has slept through the recovery period. And of course, Ireland slept with it as well. And now we are forced to deal with what with everything happening, Lenin's quote, yes, within a week span. You will never make the right decisions in the in this type of a setting. United States is exactly the same as Europe, by the way. Let's not, you know, pretend that the United States is somehow on the grand scale of things is better at that process. We are destroying that civil society. You mentioned the MEPs who objected to. And again, and as you said, it doesn't, you know, there are different reasons and they might be reasonable at all. Of course, it might be not justifiable given the circumstances in which they are objecting. But we cannot ignore the messages that they are sending. We cannot ignore the questions that they are raising. And yet our entire political and institutional setup in Europe in particular, but also in the United States, is to shut down this so-called extreme or outlier discussions. And as a result of that, focus on just center. When you keep focusing on center, you become vulnerable to exogenous shocks. And this is exactly what we're witnessing today with Ukraine. Ukraine, issue of the Ukraine, the issue not of sovereignty of Ukraine, that has been resolved, but the actual issue of the economic development, social development, integration into the European space, integration into global economy and global society. All of these issues should have been addressed over a longer period of time. They haven't been addressed. Europe has thrown at the Ukraine a promise of, we're going to, you know, encourage your greater integration, didn't do anything, then subsequently kind of walked back and forth on the same issue as well. And this is not about NATO. This is about building trade connections, investment connections, education connections, giving Ukrainians access to Europe visa free so that they can come, learn, study, live, work. You know, these are the common social development objectives, not the objectives of militarization or anything like that. Now we are forced by the circumstances to deal with the issue of how do we shove more weapons into particular countries, not just Ukraine, but other countries as well? It is clearly not a solution to the problem because we ignored the problem for too long.
The last time we spoke about the problems of orthodoxy. And we did. We spoke about, and unfortunately, I'm it's very much a case whereby, because that's one thing, you cannot be firm in the face of these things and you have to learn. And unfortunately, there's still so much that has yet, that people have, like, there are literally people I speak to on a weekly basis who tell me that austerity got Ireland out of the global financial crisis. Like, that myth still pervades. It's total and utter horseshit. Constantine, I'm going to leave it there. I'm delighted to have the conversation with you again. It's great to chat, but if I could make one comment on the militarization and the need to have those conversations, those fringe conversations, we're having them. We just need them to percolate up more. We need less people. Do you know?
But of course we do. But look, I mean, as you started by saying that, you know, I have this Soviet background. In the Soviet Union, we had kitchen politics. So we sat in the kitchen and we debated and discussed between ourselves all of the problems around the world, including the Soviet Union. They just didn't percolate to the top.
On that side, the only collusion I want to see, or I would have liked to see, was a fly on the wall when Chekhov met Tolstoy. That would have been my, you know, that would have been my favorite. Listen, we leave it there, folks. Thanks for listening. We'll be back soon and hope to see lots of you on Sunday. Thanks again, Constantine. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Tony. It's a pleasure to be here with you always and anytime.
Tony and Martin, Martin and Tony, speaking to interesting people only. It's the Echo Chamber Podcast. Subscribe now on